Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in Treating Chemotherapy-Related Nausea and Vomiting. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have reached so many of you. We have on the call today over 550 participants, and you primarily come from the United States, but we do have international participants from Canada, the Ukraine, Venezuela, and Yemen, so you really come from all over the world. And it is a credit to you. You are a group of information seekers, that's what we call you, and that's wonderful that you really want to get as much information as possible. Today's program was made possible with support from ISI Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. And there is a lot of information that could be useful to you, particularly information about all of the collaborating organizations, how to contact them, their phone numbers, and their website addresses that you can access. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to complete that evaluation form. Your feedback is critically important to us so that we do offer the programs that are most important to each of you. So tell us what you think of the program, and if there are topics you'd like us to offer going forward, please let us know so we can be sure to plan those programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today on our program, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Richard Gralla. Dr. Gralla is Medical Director, Quality of Life Research Associates. And Dr. Gralla is going to address the causes of chemotherapy side effects. He's going to talk about communicating with the healthcare team and quality of life concerns and some other issues as well. I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Gralla.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and let me add my welcome to all from New York on this anniversary of September 11th. While today our topic is advances in treating chemotherapy-related nausea and vomiting, Carolyn asked me to, as an introduction, to address why does chemotherapy cause side effects and the importance of good communication with your healthcare team. First, let's establish some common ground. What is cancer chemotherapy? Simply medicines to kill cancer cells or to affect cancer cells in ways so that other mechanisms of your body can deal with those cancerous cells. The problem is that cancer cells are our own cells. Yes, they're altered in certain ways, but they are our own. And it's very different than an infection, because bacteria are really very, very different than our own cells and then mammalian cells. Chemotherapy is designed to take advantage of the relative differences between cancer cells and normal cells. So classical chemotherapy, which is what most people receive, attacks cancer cells in the way that they grow and in the needs that those cancer cells have to maintain the cancer itself. When this type of attack overlaps with the needs of normal cells, then side effects can result. Examples of that have to do, say, with growth rates. And whereas many cancer cells may grow very quickly and chemotherapy tries to take advantage of that, so do some normal cells like white blood cells, which fight infection, so those blood counts can get low. The cells that line our mouths and our gastrointestinal tracts, that can result in mouth sores and diarrhea and other problems. Other blood cells, that can result in anemia when they're sort of innocent bystanders as well. Hair follicles, which can result in hair loss. And in a few minutes, Dr. Loprenzi will address some of these areas in more detail. Now, we have a new group of anti-cancer drugs, often called molecularly targeted agents. These medicines work often in a different anti-cancer way. So another way in which cancer cells differ from healthy cells is that their growth or reproduction is no longer under the normal strict control that our bodies have for normal cells. So a real difference between normal cells and cancer cells is this control of growth, the signals to stop growing. These new agents are often directed at the control mechanisms that may be abnormal, thus taking advantage of this difference. Often this involves receptors on the cells or in the cell, which are involved with cell growth or communication. But normal cells may have some degree of these pathways too. The difference can be that there are more of these, which is sometimes called overexpression in the cancer cells than there are with normal cells. Also, new molecular methods look at new blood cells. When a cancer reaches a certain size, it needs to make new blood vessels, and these agents sometimes interfere with these new blood vessels. And often there are differences between the blood vessels that we have all over our bodies and those that are in tumors, but some similarities overlap. Why do we get side effects? Again, from the reasons I've mentioned, the overlap between treating the cancer cell and similar mechanisms that exist in normal cells, but taking advantage of the relative but not absolute difference. Metabolism of the agent. Certain drugs, for instance, remain in the bladder and can cause problems for the bladder. With nausea and vomiting, our topic for today, the body may identify the medicine that we're using to treat the cancer as a foreign substance and thinks that we've swallowed it, so therefore the body reacts to get rid of it. Sometimes we even have allergy problems, which can be real issues in receiving anti-cancer treatment. The more we understand about how an anti-cancer agent works, and also how it causes side effects, the mechanism, the better chance we have of preventing side effects. And this is the direction of a great deal of research. Are side effects maybe a good thing? Do we believe in no pain, no gain? Not really. For the most part, this is not so. That our goal really is to achieve the gain without the pain. And for the most part, there is not so much of an association between the complete elimination, say, of nausea and vomiting. That does not prevent the chemotherapeutic agent from doing what we need it to do. So it's important to realize that we really want to prevent these so that we can continue our quality of life in the normal way. And for that, we have to communicate well. That allows us to individualize care so that your care can have as positive effect as possible on preserving and improving quality of life while at the same time having a good effect against the cancer. What's not known by the general public often is that remarkable improvements in the prevention or treatment of many of the side effects that are associated with cancer care has occurred over the past several years. And in fact, we're in an evolutionary period of how to maximize the benefit of these newer methods. Supportive care, getting rid of side effects and treating and supporting many different aspects of the real difficulties in having cancer, is at least as individualized and complicated as anti-cancer care itself. And this is why we must communicate well, because some of these problems occur only in some patients and not in others. And only through talking about these problems and communicating about them can the best remedy be applied. In fact, there's a new term that's now used called patient-reported outcomes, or PROs. This reflects that in many areas, only through proper communication with the patient and family can all truly understand the issue. Of course, in many instances, your doctor or nurse may raise the issue, but there's no need to stand on ceremony. It's fine to bring it up first. In fact, it's appreciated. Physicians and nurses, social workers and pharmacists, among others in oncology, psychologists and others, spend a great deal of time educating themselves about the best approaches to these problems. And their oncology organizations, such as ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ONS, the Oncology Nursing Society, and MASC, a very important organization, the Multinational Association for Supportive Care in Cancer, really work very hard in supporting all on this, patients, healthcare professionals, all. So we as healthcare professionals should be considered to be your team, and you should take advantage of that team. Some specialists are called experts in palliative medicine. The new approach is for patients to receive both the best of appropriate anti-cancer treatment plus the best of appropriate palliative treatment, not just one or the other. Studies have indicated that with this approach, people can live better and maybe even live longer. With many potential areas of concern, but not all involving any individual, good communication is vital to personalized care. Surveys show that patients and families are equally interested in learning more about anti-cancer treatments and ways to prevent or treat symptoms or side effects. So they're as interested in preventing symptoms and side effects as anti-cancer care, and that 95% of patients and families say that these are important or very important to them. Communication is central because that we know among nausea and vomiting problems, our main topic today, there is the issue of emesis, that is nausea and vomiting on the first day acutely, and then emesis could begin a few days later, delayed. And surveys have shown that doctors and nurses underestimate the problem, especially the delayed problem, the one that can occur a few days later. To improve communication on this issue, MASC has created a brief questionnaire that takes only a couple of minutes for a patient to complete, and now it's even available as an app for an iPhone as well as a paper questionnaire. This illustrates some directions for the future of improving communication, which affects all aspects of quality of life. While technology can assist, nothing ever replaces person-to-person, face-to-face communication. Communication includes acquiring knowledge, as cancer care does with programs like this, with its webpage, with governmental helplines like the National Cancer Institute's 1-800-FOR-CANCER, ASCO's program, American Cancer Society. These are all great. But real personalization requires close collaboration with your oncology team, especially as each of us has a different style of communicating. Our main topic today is to discuss nausea and vomiting, which is particularly appropriate as these can be problems in many aspects of cancer care, postoperatively, with radiation, with pain medicines, and many others, but it's most notorious in its association with chemotherapy. Again, our goal is to prevent the problem of nausea and vomiting, not wait till it becomes a problem. Your healthcare team individualizes nausea and vomiting control by looking at risk factors with chemotherapy. And many of these factors include, most prominently, the type of chemotherapy one's to receive, one's age, whether one's a man or a woman. It's more difficult to control nausea and vomiting in younger patients than in women, and how well one did with the last chemotherapy that one received. Now, this last reason is a really important one to communicate. If one had no nausea or vomiting with the last chemotherapy and little or no side effects, then of course one would continue with that nausea and vomiting prevention. But if there were problems, then the antiemetic prevention should be altered and personalized. So next I'm going to hand over to Dr. Grunberg, who will discuss the actual way that nausea and vomiting are prevented and other useful topics. Steve?
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grala, for an excellent, really outstanding presentation. And now we are going to have Dr. Stephen Grunberg speak next. He's professor of medicine and pharmacology, University of Vermont. And Dr. Grunberg is going to address managing nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, practical tips to deal with fatigue and infection control, and guidelines for dental care during chemotherapy. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grunberg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be part of the program today. Nausea and vomiting has been what Dr. Grala emphasized, and rightfully so, because those are the side effects of chemotherapy that are of most concern to most patients. However, they're not the only side effects, and they're certainly not seen with every type of chemotherapy. As Dr. Grala pointed out, the type of chemotherapy itself is actually the greatest determinant. Some types of chemotherapy without appropriate treatment might cause nausea or vomiting in most patients. Other types really wouldn't cause it at all. In addition, nausea and vomiting cannot be viewed in isolation. None of these side effects that we deal with with chemotherapy or with cancer treatment or with cancer itself can be viewed by themselves, since they're all part of the complex systems that make up the human body. They're all tied together, and the strategies that we use for any one problem are also going to affect how we deal with the others. So starting with the what you might call the gastrointestinal side effects, we can start go everywhere from the mouth, from the teeth, through the stomach, to nausea and vomiting, to what goes on with the lower bowels and intestines. For nausea and vomiting, we have had a huge amount of research and a huge practical experience and theoretical work in terms of what causes nausea and vomiting and how to prevent it. We know, as was pointed out before, that nausea and vomiting is a preventive reflex. It's a way that the body tries to rid itself of substances that it knows can be harmful to living cells. Of course, the living cells we're trying to harm are the cancer cells, but the body may not be able to make that complete distinction. To be a reflex, we know this is going to be a neural pathway. It's going to go through our nervous system, and our nervous system has numerous different pathways and numerous different connecting points within it. As we try to figure out how to prevent nausea and vomiting, we try to understand what these different pathways are and how the messages are sent between different cells and different nerves. With the different types of nausea and or the different types of vomiting, the vomiting that may appear right after chemotherapy, vomiting that may appear several days later, vomiting that might even appear before later chemotherapy, just from the memory of chemotherapy-induced vomiting, we know that the pathways may differ and that each one may require different remedies. There are some general regimens that we use for almost all of our patients starting chemotherapy that have been highly successful. But by communicating, by knowing what actually happened to each individual during their course of chemotherapy, we can help to figure out where we're achieving our goal and where we may still have a ways to go to figure out what medications should be left the same and what medications might be changed. And again, as was pointed out, for many of these problems, particularly ones that happen that may happen when you're not right at the doctor's office, the only way we're going to know about it is if you tell us. About every 10 years, we get not just a new anti-vomiting drug, but a new family of anti-vomiting drugs. And each time that happens, our ability to control vomiting improves. One of the important insights that we've had recently was one that you might say was right in front of us all the time, and that's that nausea and vomiting are not the same thing. Oftentimes they run together, but it's certainly possible to have nausea without vomiting or vomiting without nausea. We also know that everybody describes nausea in a different way. What might be nausea to one person might just be a bit of an upset stomach to somebody else. So even if what's happening to you doesn't exactly match your idea of the question the doctor is asking, if the doctor says, were you nauseous after this chemotherapy, tell the doctor or nurse what is going on, because there may be some other problem, some related problem that can be addressed. As a matter of fact, we're now finding that some of the, what we used to call anti-nausea and vomiting drugs are better at stopping vomiting than they are at nausea, while others may be better at stopping nausea than they are at vomiting. So the more we can understand what's happening to you, the better job that we can do in trying to control it. Sometimes we find that our medications themselves, our remedies themselves, can cause additional problems, or sometimes the cancer can cause additional problems that we have to deal with. And this is where we move down, you might say, down the GI tract to diarrhea and constipation. Diarrhea can be the result of certain types of cancer, certain types of bowel disease. Diarrhea can also be the result of certain types of chemotherapy. Besides just being unpleasant, the thing that concerns us about diarrhea is that it can rapidly lead to dehydration. And dehydration is one of our worst enemies when we're trying to treat the cancer patient. Dehydration can actually make some types of some medications that we give more dangerous or cause more side effects from those medications than you would have found if there wasn't dehydration. Dehydration can also make you feel dizzy. It can make you feel weak. It can affect all of your body's vital organs, even the ones that are doing perfectly fine and weren't affected at all by the cancer or by the chemotherapy itself can be affected by the dehydration. So we try to have our patients maintain good nutrition, but I tell my patients that if they feel they can only take a limited amount in, the really important thing is to prevent dehydration. For some types of diarrhea, if we know that it's not, for example, an infection, that we should be treating it with an antibiotic, if it's a drug-induced diarrhea, we might give an agent to slow the bowels, an anti-diarrheal agent. And we may even use some of the ones that one sees over the counter, the same ones that you would get in the grocery store. The thing is that for our purposes, when we're trying to stop the kind of diarrhea associated with some of the medications that we give, we may have to use higher doses, sometimes even higher doses than you're going to find written on the box. So I would say that if your doctor does tell you to take such an agent or to buy such an agent in the drugstore, you want to discuss with your doctor or nurse exactly when they want you to take it and how much they want you to take, because the amount they may want you to take may be different than what would be written on the box for a simple stomach ache. Constipation can come from many causes. Certain types of cancer can cause a blockage of the bowel. We have to be very careful about that. But certain medications that we use can cause constipation as well. Many of the painkillers, the narcotic painkillers that we give, will cause severe constipation. And even some of the anti-nausea drugs that we give can cause constipation. And we certainly don't want to let constipation get out of hand, because that can be, of course, extremely uncomfortable and can lead to bowel blockages and such on its own. With some of the agents, most physicians know that if you're giving a patient narcotic painkillers, it is highly likely that you will also have to give something to prevent the constipation. But many people don't realize that some other drugs, even some of our anti-vomiting drugs, can also cause constipation. If that is the problem you're running into, once again, tell your doctors or nurses, because they may be able to change the dose of the drug or change the drug, you know, or change the drugs that we're giving you for other purposes to avoid that problem. In terms of dental care, we always recommend very good dental care. Certainly, poorly kept teeth can be a major source of infection, and we're very concerned about infections in our patients who are receiving chemotherapy. In certain settings, this can be an even greater problem. If a patient needs radiation to the mouth, for example, the mouth may become very, very dry, which predisposes to further infection. And if you do have such a cancer and are requiring radiation treatments for it, your radiation oncologist will probably require a very careful dental evaluation, may even recommend that if there are any teeth that are in bad shape, that they may be removed, and may provide certain fluoride trays or other devices to help strengthen the remaining teeth. They will also emphasize keeping the teeth clean, flossing, brushing your teeth. Again, this is not just to make you look pretty, it's to protect your teeth and also to protect your overall health and to protect and to prevent infections. In addition, we do have to be very careful. Certain agents we use to stop other side effects, such as some of the ones that we use to harden bones, or let's say radiation that happens to be, as I said, to the mouth and near the bones, can in some ways weaken the bone and can lead to what's called an osteonecrosis, some breakdown of the bone. This can happen particularly if there's an oral surgery or some other major manipulation of the bone. So if you are undergoing treatment and you're thinking of getting some dental work done, particularly some major dental work, you absolutely need to talk to your doctor or nurse, because they may have to talk to your dentist or oral surgeon and work out a plan that's safe for you. In terms of infections, we're always watching out for infections. Good hand washing, common sense, go a long way to preventing infections. If your doctor has told you that your resistance is down, well, don't go out in crowds. Don't take visitors who you know are ill. And if you've been told that your resistance is down and you do get a fever, or even if you don't get a fever but get a heart-shaking chill, it's very important to let your doctors and nurses know right away, since if your body can't protect itself from an infection, we have to get in there quickly to help it out with strong antibiotics. One other topic, and perhaps the most general topic, is fatigue. Tiredness. Quite frankly, just about everybody who has to go through cancer treatment is going to get fatigue to one level or another at one time or another. This is a lot to go through. This is probably one of the hardest jobs you've ever done. And there's certainly nothing wrong from getting tired while you're trying to do it. But there are numerous different causes of fatigue. And if we know that's happening, we can watch out for them. Dehydration itself can cause the feeling of fatigue. If we know you're tired and we check and that's the case, we can give you extra fluid. fluids. Anemia, which comes with many different types of treatment, can cause fatigue. And if we have to help you to replenish your blood supply, we can do that. For some types of treatment, for example, again, going back to an example I've mentioned before, radiation for head and neck cancers, even a couple years later, a person may develop a low thyroid, a thyroid problem that can lead to fatigue. But this is very, very easy to fix if we know the problem is there. If you say you're tired, we can do a blood test, we can find out if the thyroid is weak, and we can replace that thyroid hormone very, very easily. Even in the absence of all these, you may very well be fatigued while you're going through the treatment. And there's always the continuing question of exercise or not. Should I rest all the time or should I push myself all the time? Now, we're not telling you to push yourself to a ridiculous extent. You know, this is not the time to take up marathon running. On the other hand, making yourself totally still, not doing anything to rest up because you're feeling tired, may not be the best thing either. We've actually found that maintaining a certain level of exercise, as much as you feel you can, is actually better. It keeps the muscles going, it keeps the blood flowing, it avoids blood clots and may actually make you feel better. So not to overdo, not to totally wear yourself out, but a certain amount of activity, a certain amount of exercise. You know, if you used to go for 5-mile runs, well, you might want to go for a 1-mile walk. But even the fact that you're getting out and doing something is going to help your energy, and it will actually help the fatigue. So all of these things tie together. All of these things are important, and your healthcare team is there, you know, again, with a great deal of experience in many of these areas to help you. But as Dr. Grella mentioned, for many of these, there's no blood test for tiredness. You know, there's no blood test for nausea. We're only going to know it if you tell us. You know, you help us to help you, and we'll do the best we can. So thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grunberg. And such an important message to everybody about, please, you know, do tell your healthcare team, your physician, if there's something bothering you so that they can address it. Thank you so much for that important message. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Charles Laprinzi. Dr. Laprinzi is the Regis Professor of Breast Cancer Research, the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Laprinzi is going to address managing mouth sores and dry mouth, describing neuropathy to your healthcare team, and tips to cope with neuropathy. And he may add some other things as well. Dr. Laprinzi?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be speaking back again to this audience. My topics, the first one of them is managing mouth sores and dry mouth problems. Mouth sores can be a big problem in some patients receiving cancer treatment because the mouth cells turn over frequently, and when you give treatment, that can actually prevent them from turning over and cause these sores. Very, very common with radiation therapy. Common with some chemotherapy drugs, such as 5-fluorouracil, otherwise called 5-FU, or methotrexate. Other drugs can do it sometime, too. I'll tell you a quick story that was one of our best research adventures in this area, and that is when we give 5-fluorouracil, or 5-FU, that's given intravenously as a bolus drug frequently. And when you do that, there's something called a half-life of the drug, and that means the time when there's only half as much of that drug left in your bloodstream. And the half-life for 5-FU is relatively short, like 10 minutes. So 10 minutes later, only half as much in your blood. 10 minutes after that, half as much of that, or a quarter. So it goes away relatively quickly. The nurses came up with an idea. What about putting ice chips in the mouth right before you give the 5-FU, like snow cone-type ice chips? Replenish those with the spoon, and so you keep that cold stuff in your mouth for a total of 30 minutes when there's a lot of 5-FU in the blood. And it turns out that in a trial that was done where half the people had that done and half the people did not have that done, and we followed them to see how many mouth sores they got over the next 5 to 7, 8 days, it turns out that the people who got the ice chips had half as much mouth sore problem than the people who did not get the ice chips. This study has been repeated many times and is now recommended for this 5-FU to get the ice chips in the mouth to help prevent it, and that's the rationale for why that is. Now, if people already have the problem, then there are some things that can be done. The most common thing is to get a little bit of salt, like a half a teaspoon of salt and a half a teaspoon of baking soda, put in a cup of warm water, and rinse with that every 3 or 4 hours. Some people think putting salt on a wound, that might make it worse, but this dilute amount of salt really seems to help patients that have this particular problem. It's not been proven in a clinical trial, but it's established that everybody thinks that's beneficial. In addition, there are sometimes other medications that can be given, like lidocaine, novocaine, that you get for numbing your teeth in a solution, or other, there are these magic mouthwash solutions that have a little lidocaine in them and a little Maalox or something like that. And some of those things could be helpful for patients who have this problem. For patients who have dryness of the mouth that comes after finishing radiation therapy, that can be a problem that lasts for a long, long time. Usually the mouth sores is just for a matter of days or weeks, but the dry mouth can be for a long time. And there is a medication called pilocarpine or Cialogen that is helpful for patients who have that particular problem. So let me switch bases here to another topic that I've been asked to cover, and that is chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. It, again, is a common problem. It's not caused by all drugs, but it's caused by a number of drugs which are commonly used. The drugs that are often associated with this problem are platinum drugs. There are three that I will mention, cisplatin, oxaliplatin, oftentimes used for colon cancer, and carboplatin. Carboplatin is not as big a problem, but cisplatin and oxaliplatin are a big problem with neuropathy. Another group of drugs that causes this problem are the taxanes, paclitaxel, otherwise commonly called Taxol, or docetaxel, otherwise commonly called Taxotere. Both can cause a lot of trouble with neuropathy. I'm going to describe what the neuropathy is like in just a moment or so. Vincristine is another drug that can cause this problem, used for in children and also for some hematologic malignancies, blood-type cancers. And then there are some multiple myeloma drugs, such as bortezomib, that can cause this neuropathy. Now, what the heck is this neuropathy? The symptoms that we get, that patients get primarily with this neuropathy, are usually things that start in the hands or feet. We call it stocking glove presentation because it starts in those particular areas. It can come more proximal or closer to the body, go up the arm, hands up to the mid-arms or the feet up to the knees or so. Rarely goes farther than that. It can, the symptoms are oftentimes numbness, tingling, or pain, oftentimes described as a shooting burning pain. And when you look at this closely, for most drugs, the numbness and tingling are much more common problems and to a higher degree in, when you ask people to rate them, than is the pain. In pain, the people who get the pain, it can be quite problematic, but usually it's numbness and tingling the problem more so than pain. Oftentimes comes on as you get more and more of the chemotherapy, doesn't go away in between times, so that after 2 or 3 or 4 months, people can have more and more of this problem. It can limit how much chemotherapy we give because we don't want the problem to be too bad. Oftentimes it will get better after the chemotherapy is stopped, but not in everybody. And some people will have problems from this chemotherapy for months or years thereafterwards. And occasionally it will get worse after stopping the treatment, or even less often, but occasionally it can start after finishing the treatment. Now, we call that chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, or CIPN. There are some acute neuropathy syndromes, so something that happens right after you get the drug for within the first day or 2 or 3 days, and then tends to go away. Oxaliplatin is one drug that has that, and it's a different sort of thing, and it's things such as cold things like the air in where I live in Minnesota at wintertime, or putting your hand in the refrigerator to pick up something there, that the cold can cause a lot of cramping and other pain problems. Usually gets better within a few days after each dose, but can come back with the next one. Paclitaxel or Taxol also has a problem that's peculiar to this drug, that a day or two or three after getting the drug intravenously, people can get some aches and pains. They can be quite severe in some patients, and when you give big doses of this drug, up to 50% of patients need narcotics to help take care of it. And it used to be called arthralgias myalgias, which because we used to think was related to the joints, that's the arthralgia, or the muscle, which is the myalgia name. But now it appears that it actually is a form of nerve toxicity, and people who get more of that toxicity with each cycle of chemotherapy seem to get more of the neuropathy weeks or months later. What about prevention of these problems? There's no proof of anything yet other than lowering the dose of the chemotherapy that can prevent these problems. The most promising thing there is that there's information that if you give intravenous calcium and magnesium right before and after you give oxaliplatin that it can decrease the amount of neuropathy that patients get. One randomized trial demonstrated that that seemed to be quite helpful. It wasn't as definitive as people wanted, so another trial has been conducted. All of the patients were entered, and now the data are being analyzed, and we'll see whether or not that is really something that does help. Other things that have been studied, such as glutathione or minocycline, and other drugs too. As far as treatment, our last topic here, the treatment of people who already have this problem, there's no real good thing yet to treat this problem other than tincture of thyme, and hopefully it gets better with that. There was a recent study presented at our annual meeting in June that duloxetine, otherwise called Cymbalta, which is an antidepressant medication, that it decreased this neuropathy pain in patients a little bit more than did a placebo. Not a great amount more, but a little bit more, and something we call statistically significant difference. So that's one option to use. The drugs that have most commonly been used, gabapentin, otherwise called Neurontin, or pregabalin, otherwise called Lyrica, they've been used a lot for treatment of this problem because they're useful for other neuropathy pain syndromes. However, only one randomized trial was done looking at one of these drugs, that being gabapentin, and that study was convincingly negative. It didn't show any benefit, and those drugs do have some side effects. So although they're used and some patients and some doctors swear by them, it's not a great drug for this particular thing, and hopefully we can find new things for it. Other things such as acetyl-L-carnitine are being looked at for this particular problem. So let me stop at this time, and I turn it back to Carolyn, and then I think she's going to have questions for the group.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lipinski, for an excellent presentation and very comprehensive. Before we take questions, I just want to say a few words about hair loss, because I think that that's a really important issue for many of you on the call in terms of how to cope with hair loss. Now, everyone who has chemotherapy does not have hair loss, but sometimes it does happen. And when it does happen, it does affect how one looks and may change how one looks. And I think that then the issue is what does one do about that? Now, there are many ways to cope with hair loss and lots of choices for people. And there is a program the American Cancer Society sponsors called a Look Good, Feel Better program that actually is a wonderful program that actually is throughout the country. And so many of your communities may have an office for that service. And they really help people to kind of decide what's best for them. But in terms of just the choices, some people do know, first of all, ahead of time. Their physicians may let them know that there is the possibility that they may lose their hair and often recommend that they begin to think about what they'd like to do. And the standard choices are that some people may decide to purchase a wig or to get a wig donated to them. Many of these nonprofit organizations, American Cancer Society, offers a wig to people that actually helps the person to maintain somewhat of what they looked like before in terms of the wig. Some people like to have a hat or wear different types of hats or scarves to handle it. And some people choose not to do anything to disclose. They like to have their be bald. They don't want to do anything to disclose the fact that they have lost their hair. So there are many choices, and the idea is to find the best fit for you, what would work best for you in terms of how you would like to cope. And that often, I know that our social work staff here at Cancer Care will spend time talking with people about what they'd like to do, and also in support groups or individual counseling, people talk these things out. Because I think that often, you know, cancer isn't a visible disease to people, and people make choices about disclosing about their cancer. And so the hair loss sometimes is a change in appearance, and one has to decide, you know, what one would like to do in coping with that. So there are lots of choices, and there are a lot of support people out there to help you, both your healthcare team, your physician, the people in your family and friends who know you, how you'd like to best cope with it. So I hope that's helpful. And now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. And Stephanie would explain to you then how to queue up and ask questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Zoe B. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a question about the use of benzodiazepines to control nausea during chemotherapy. It comes from personal experience. I was treated with gemcitabine and cisplatin for bladder cancer in 2010 and 11. They tried every possible anti-nausea drug. Because of the severity of the headaches and the increase in blood pressure, all those failed. They finally tried Xanax, which I thought was a little odd, but it worked. I don't understand why it worked.
Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask Dr. Grunberg to address your question in a general way, and he'll probably address it not specifically to you, but perhaps to everyone. Then you can go back, hopefully, to your healthcare team and see what fits for you. Dr. Grunberg?
Well, actually, there are many different neural pathways that contribute to problems with nausea and vomiting. One of the things we know that certainly affects the amount of nausea and vomiting is anxiety. And whether you realize it or not, whether you're actually feeling anxious, anxiety can be a big part of this experience, particularly if you've had bad experiences with nausea and vomiting from your chemotherapy before. So we don't usually use benzodiazepines as first-line agents because they're not as specific for some of the nausea and vomiting pathways as the other. But for patients who are having problems or who have had repeated problems, which is often called anticipatory component of vomiting, we found that benzodiazepines can indeed be quite effective.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, our next question.
Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
And we do have a question from one of our online participants, from Catherine, and the question is, what are your thoughts about using ginger to help with nausea? Dr. LaPrinzi, do you want to address that?
I certainly can, and my two colleagues may have some thoughts also on that. And most of us as kids understood that when we were sick, we got ginger ale, and I'm one of 10 children with 11 and a half years top to bottom and no twins, and we didn't have pop unless somebody was sick. And that's where the ginger story came from, and there's a lot of evidence from Chinese medicine and other that ginger might be helpful for helping some nausea and vomiting problems. There was a trial that was presented a couple of years ago that suggested that had some information supporting that ginger would decrease nausea on one day of treatment after treatment. That study has yet to be published, and the other days didn't seem to be of much benefit. So my own bias is I think that it's a little bit too little too late and doesn't overpower the bad nausea and vomiting caused by chemotherapy. But let me turn it over to one of my other two colleagues to get their two cents on this.
Well, ginger actually has a very interesting history in this area, not just going back to our own childhoods. As Dr. LaPrinzi mentioned, it came out of Chinese medicine and Asian medicine originally. The history of ginger in Western medicine actually goes back about 400 years to the time when it was first mentioned in the literature out of England, and it's remained as a common remedy, a folk remedy, since then. The clinical research, there are a number of research, actually small studies looking at different types of nausea and vomiting, not just with chemotherapy, but also motion sickness and many others. The results are really not that clear, but when one looks at, you might say, the scientific criteria for the study, whether exactly the best possible dose to use was identified, that's all not that clear either. So as far as I'm concerned, the jury is still out, and there's still a lot of work to be done in this area to see if it's going to, I doubt whether it's going to replace everything we do, but it'll be interesting to see if it might help other things we do. And as we mentioned before, there are some agents that are very good for vomiting. There are some agents that are very good for nausea. And ginger might turn out to be one of those agents that's helpful for nausea, but even though it may have very little effect on vomiting itself.
Well, let me put my two cents in also. I think that there are many, many agents and substances that can have a little bit of an effect on nausea and maybe a little bit of an effect on vomiting, and that for everyday sore stomach, such as happened in the LaPrinzi family with all those kids, must have happened almost every week, this could be helpful. But when it comes to cancer chemotherapy, you have to remember that some of the chemotherapy medicines cause nausea and vomiting if somebody does not receive a good anti-nausea agent in 100% of the patients. And here you need something really good. And we have some really good stuff these days. You've heard of drugs like aprepitant, which is an NK1 antagonist. You've heard of drugs like Zofran or palonosetron, which are serotonin antagonists, and even corticosteroid-like drugs. These are powerful agents against a powerful problem that can help. That's not to say that these other drugs can't help a little bit, but they're really clear that ginger is not up to that par. Whether it will have a role for nausea other than the one day that seemed to indicate in the one trial, good studies need to be done. But the main agents are the things that prevent so much nausea and vomiting in so many patients. While other drugs can be helpful, or like the Xanax or benzodiazepines that can be adjuncts to anti-nausea medicines, that is, help in other ways, the main agents are the things that make the most difference and are our first line of protection.
Excellent. Thank you very much. An excellent discussion here. And our next question is from one of our online participants about constipation. It's a big issue. I take Marilax, and would Metamucil help too, is the question.
Of course, the answer is maybe. Metamucil is a very interesting substance. It increases bulk, and actually, if you're constipated, it may help soften your stool. If you have diarrhea, some people would say that it may also help give your stool bulk. So it's something that one can try, but the individual responses can be quite variable.
I might add that constipation is a very, 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 very big problem in people who are on narcotic medications, morphine, that sort of medication. And that's the biggest situation where we see this. And Miralax or Senna compounds can be actually quite helpful, but you may have to use a higher dose than we usually see written on the when you get it over the counter. And sometimes going up and up on the dose to the point where it causes some loose stool is the way I usually go with practice. And I don't know that Metamucil, it's kind of spitting in the ocean to me, I think. It doesn't seem to be strong enough to be helpful, although it's in some compounds.
We should also say, you know, we pointed out how we're understanding more about the nervous system and neuropathways and receptors that affect these different things. There's actually at least one new agent specifically for narcotic-induced constipation that has shown the capability of reversing narcotic-induced constipation without reversing the pain-killing effects of the narcotic. So this kind of agent, what's called a peripherally acting opiate antagonist, can also be very promising for some of the more severe cases of constipation.
Oh, that's excellent. Thank you. And another question now from one of our online participants is that I have diarrhea and constipation, so both, and can't strike a balance between stool softeners causing diarrhea and stopping it and then getting constipated. Any suggestions? And again, a general, if you could give some general guidelines, and then we would recommend, of course, that go back to their healthcare team.
Well, I guess the way I would look at it is, and that is such a problem, there are many reasons to have that complex syndrome of diarrhea or constipation, and understanding the reason for it is more important than selecting a medicine. And this is something that should go right back to your healthcare team right away. You know, when we consider bowel problems, it's always such a personal and private matter that often we don't want to bring it up or whatever, but this would require real good discussion. Sometimes people who have been troubled by constipation for a long time have an obstruction that leads to diarrhea around the constipation, and that kind of impaction needs particular care. That may not be the issue for this person. It may be other medications that are involved or whatever. But this would require a good physical examination, maybe some studies, and really understanding what the issue is. And this is where communication comes in first. But you don't have to live with this. And this is where I would definitely want my healthcare team to be involved. And if I need a specialist with this, those folks could be very helpful as well.
Excellent. Thank you. I have another question about the ice chips. Wow, ice chips for 5-FU. Can I eat fruit ices instead?
So when we developed this, this was a trial that my research team developed years ago, you would think this is something that's totally without any side effects and why not do it for all? It actually wasn't quite that simple because it turned out that the nurses couldn't put their pop in the ice machine as much because there wasn't as much ice there. So there's always side effects with some things. And the other thing that more seriously is that when people get chemotherapy, they can get nausea or funny taste in their mouth and that sort of thing. And they can associate that bad feeling with the ice chips that they're having. So they have to be careful not to have something that they actually like, because they may well not like it afterwards. They'll associate it like Pavlov's dog's association came about. So our nurses sometimes use popsicles, but if people like cherry popsicles, don't use cherry. Use root beer or something you don't like so that they'll still like the cherry popsicles.
And the next question from one of our online participants is, I am so tired and just can't get out of bed. What should I do? I don't know, Dr. Grunberg, if you'd like to address that.
Well, as I said, there are so many different reasons to be tired. You should discuss this with the doctors, with your doctors and nurses, with your healthcare team, so that they can do a complete evaluation, a physical examination, and blood tests if necessary, to try to figure out if there's a particular problem that can be reversed. Are you dehydrated? Are you anemic? Is your thyroid working well? Any one of these can be an important factor. They may not be able to find every reason, and as I said, when we say to remain active, it's as active as you feel up to. You very well may require more rest than you did before, but at least they can check you out and see if there's anything that they can help you to reverse or help to make better. It's probably the most complex problem we deal with.
Excellent. And another question from one of our online participants, Rebecca. Could someone discuss the use of Sancuso patch for the treatment of nausea?
Which patch was that?
Sancuso patch?
This is a patch of a standard anti-emetic drug called granisetron, but by putting it in patch form, it actually goes slowly into through the skin into the bloodstream over a period of about 5 days. So it could be very much like giving repeated doses of one of our frontline anti-vomiting drugs, and it can be effective. I know that certain groups of patients in my own clinic have responded very well to this administration of this particular drug. We should realize what's unique about Sancuso is the delivery system. It's a different way of giving one of the drugs that we know is one of the good drugs for vomiting.
Excellent. Could you say something then about the delivery system of the different medications for, that's an excellent point, about for treating chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting? Is there something about that? Is that changing now?
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay. There are many, many different ways of giving these different drugs. The most common ones and the ones you usually hear about would be giving them by vein or giving them in pill form. But for some people, neither one of those may be the best way to do it. We just mentioned the patch. That can be a long-acting form of the drug. There's another formulation where a small pellet containing the drug is injected under the skin. That can dissolve over periods of time. Sometimes, rather than a pill, you can use what's called an orally disintegrating tablet. These, you just put them on your tongue or under your tongue, and they'll just dissolve right there. So if you're having trouble swallowing, you don't have to swallow these tablets. All you have to do is put them inside your mouth. Some other thin films with the drug on it can be used the same way, just put within the cheek. And then there's some companies that are developing nasal sprays and other ways of giving the drug. So there's really a large number of different ways. You shouldn't not be able to get the drug because there's no way to get it to you. Now, different drugs will work for different people, but there are so many different possible ways to deliver these drugs that I think you could probably find a good one for most anybody. I mean, for kids, some of them even come in the form of flavored syrups.
This is amazing. So there's a lot of promise in terms of what's being developed. And I have to thank, you've been amazing speakers today, Dr. Grala, Dr. Grunberg, and Dr. Prinzi. You are a winning team, excellent information, and just helped everybody on the call today. And all of you who've queued up both on the phone and also online to ask questions, and really, I know you ask the questions to get help yourself, but you end up helping everybody and allowing our speakers to actually spend more time addressing important issues. I want to thank everyone for participating today, and I want to remind everyone that that although the program will soon end, that there are many services that you can access from Cancer Care. So I don't want you to leave the program feeling like you're alone. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and all the different services that you can access from Cancer Care. So Cancer Care has a host of services to offer you, and those services include practical and financial assistance. We have a lot of counseling services. We have over 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide someone to talk to about your concerns or questions. We also offer support groups, and we do those support groups over the telephone and online. We also, of course, have many of these Connect education workshops on many different topics, and we encourage you to take a part in those. Many of you on the call are very informed consumers, very great information seekers, and they give you a chance to get information right from our experts, and that's so important to have that information. In addition, Cancer Care does have many publications and fact sheets that you can order from us. They're free and they're available to you. And we also offer community programs as well. So most importantly, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone when you are dealing with cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And we're here to provide any support that we can. We're simply a phone call away, 1-800-813-HOPE. Or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.